Senate Bill 193A has been carried over to Monday. So I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 167A. Teresa?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 167A clarifies the authority of the real estate agency to only issue real estate licenses to individuals. It defines a non-licensed individual for the purposes of distinguishing who can conduct professional real estate activity or real estate rental management. It also defines an expired, an inactive, or a lapsed license. The measure also conforms statutory language to more effectively used defined terms, user-defined terms, and also authorizes the real estate agency to adopt rules relating to an inactive or suspended licensee that's acting on their own behalf. The bill declares an emergency effective on passage. It passed unanimously out of the Senate Business Committee and out of the Senate with a 27-2 vote.
I'm going to call Lori Skillman. And while she's coming up, members, at 3:45, I'm going to leave, and I'm going to leave it in the able hands of Representative Holvey. If there's any contentious issues arise, just carry it over till Monday, or excuse me, Wednesday. I'm confident that won't happen, but... I have a meeting with
some never know with me.
Important people.
Never know with any of us.
All right. Very good. Ma'am, go ahead whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Chair Schaffler, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Laurie Skillman. I'm with the Oregon Real Estate Agency, and I'm here testifying in support of Senate Bill 167A. Senate Bill 167A is a housekeeping bill that the agency requested, and it clarifies throughout our real estate statutes that only individuals may have real estate licenses. Our statute currently has the word individuals and persons. Statutorily, the term persons includes corporations, limited liability companies, etc. So a lot of the bill is real lengthy because these terms appear throughout the statutes, and they needed to be clarified throughout the statutes. The second thing is that there are a number of terms that describe an individual who had a real estate license but whose license has been expired, lapsed, suspended, and so on. There were a variety of terms used. A lot of those terms were never defined in statute. Part of the bill is to clarify and use a single term for those individuals as non-licensed persons so that we would know that if you didn't have a license, didn't have an active real estate license, then you could not perform professional real estate activity. In the Senate, there were a couple of changes to the bill. Two of them were technical amendments. One was to define certain terms in our definitional statutes. And we defined three terms, expired, inactive, and lapsed, just so that everyone would know exactly what those terms meant. We also cleaned up a small part of our exemptions section so that our terms would be used consistently for non-licensed individuals who are allowed to perform professional real estate activity without a license. There are certain things that we exempt from statute depending upon the person. And then there were two rulemaking provisions that were added. One was at the request of a representative of a collaborative rulemaking group that the agency had for property managers. Property managers currently have to keep all their records within the state of Oregon. And what this provision does is allow the commissioner to write rules for keeping some of those records out of state. It's a real problem when you have a large, for example, large property management company, and they have records on their servers in other states. So we just wanted to have a provision that would allow the agency to provide by rule for that. And finally, there's another rulemaking provision that allows the commissioner to adopt rules for brokers whose licenses are, who have a license, but that license is inactive, expired, or suspended, to allow for them to still have to disclose to other parties in a transaction that that person does have a real estate license, therefore is more knowledgeable, has more experience about the real estate business. So, primarily a housekeeping statute. The Property Management Rules Working Group asked for an emergency clause on this bill so that we could write rules for them as soon as possible. If you have any questions.
Representative Escobar, please.
Yes, pertaining to the situation of disclosing the fact that you have real estate knowledge. Of course, this has been back in 2002. When I first started, I thought that you, as a licensed individual in the state of Oregon, even after you had inactivated your license, had to disclose that in a contractual agreement on an earnest money. Was I incorrect, or did they change the law? This was about 15 years ago.
Through the chair, Representative Escobar, I wasn't around at that particular time, so I can't give you the total history on it. But if an individual no longer has a license, then the agency really doesn't have jurisdiction over them. So it's not like they would be practicing without a license. So after a real estate licensee retires and 3 years later decides to sell his own house in a private transaction, it would seem that the agency wouldn't have jurisdiction over them to require them to disclose that fact to a party on the other side of the transaction. That's the way it currently is right now.
Any further questions of Ms. Gilman today? All righty then. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
It's a public hearing. Would anyone else like to testify to Senate Bill 167A? Seeing no one, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 167A and open a work session on Senate Bill 167A. Representative Escobar.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 167A to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Escobar moves Senate Bill 167A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Kristen, please.
Aye.
Would anyone want representative? I think you're a realtor.
I think
may have to declare a conflict. And I just anyone that is not a realtor, Representative Holby, carry this bill. Sure. Thank you. I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 167A. I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 482A.
Mr. Chair, committee members, Senate Bill 482A establishes that if a notice of compensation is filed with an escrow agent under more than 10 days prior to the scheduled closing date, the real estate broker or principal real estate broker that files the notice is required to deliver a copy of the notice to the buyer or seller that's identified in the notice. The measure also establishes that if the notice is filed within 10 days of the scheduled closing date, a copy of the notice shall be provided by the escrow agent to the principal that is identified in the notice. The measure also changes the terms commission and demand to compensation in statute governing real estate and escrow transactions.
Thank you. I have Janet. Oh, I'm going to call Janet Jarvis. While she's coming up, I'm going to close this public hearing on Senate Bill, come on up, 482A, and reopen a public hearing on Senate Bill 167A. Representative Escobar.
Yes, I want to declare a potential conflict of interest since I am a realtor. So
thank you.
This may affect me in the long run.
Thank you, Representative. I still believe it could be covered on the floor, but better safe than sorry. Close public hearing on House Senate Bill 167A, and I'm going to reopen a public hearing on Senate Bill 482A. Representative Escobar.
Yes, again, I want to declare a potential conflict of interest on 482A as I am a realtor.
Thank you, Representative. Ms. Jarvis, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, Jana Jarvis, representing the 18,000-plus members of the Oregon Association of Realtors. Senate Bill 482A is essentially a housekeeping bill as well. You're going to apparently have a series of those today. The largest change in this particular provision is the change from commission to compensation, which reflects changing business practices in the real estate industry and has created some confusion on the part of consumers when they receive this notice of demand, which is kind of a title that concerns them. So we're changing that to notice of compensation and changing the word commission to compensation to reflect different forms of payment in this industry. And that's largely the nuts and bolts of this particular bill. I'd be happy to answer any questions if you have them.
Thank you, Ms. Jarvis. No one signed up. Was there any opposition to this bill in the Senate? Okay, thank you very much. Any questions of Ms. Jarvis? All right. Thank you very much. I'm going to close public hearing on Senate Bill 482A, open work session on Senate Bill 482A. Representative Esbaum.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move 482A to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Esbaum moves Senate Bill 482A to the floor with due pass recommendations. Is there discussion? Kristen, please.
Aye.
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 Aye. We have a volunteer to carry this bill on the floor. Representative Edwards, thank you very much. I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 482A, and I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 563A.
Mr. Chair, committee members, Senate Bill 563A clarifies that the director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services must establish a managed care provider's plan that meets quality, continuity, and other treatment standards that are adopted by the managed care provider in accordance with processes approved by the director and is timely, effective, and convenient for the injured worker. The measure has the support of the Management Labor Advisory Committee and passed unanimously out of the Senate Commerce Committee as well as the Senate.
Thank you. I have Ramona St. George and Jerry Mannequin, please. Whenever you're ready, ma'am.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Ramona St. George. I'm the president and CEO of Oregon Health Systems. We are a state-certified managed care organization in the state of Oregon, as well as several other western states. I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to testify today in support of Senate Bill 563. This bill was sponsored by Senator Vicky Walker at the request of Oregon Health Systems, Kaiser on the Job, and Providence MCO, two other state-certified MCOs in the state of Oregon. During the 2005 legislative session, Senator Walker sponsored and the legislature passed Senate Bill 670. Senate Bill 670 was introduced to clarify the requirement that managed care organizations include in their applications for certification a description of the MCO's process for developing or adopting guidelines relating to the treatment of injured workers. The intent of Senate Bill 670 was to ensure that there was medical oversight of the treatment guideline development process and that injured workers were receiving similar clinical oversight to what is provided for in group health managed care settings. Unfortunately, during the implementation of Senate Bill 670, meaning the administrative rulemaking process, it became clear that the statutory language contained in 670 was sufficiently unclear that the interpretation was that the MCOs were required not to submit their process for adopting treatment guidelines, but all of their individual treatment protocols and guidelines. So for every conceivable treatment or diagnosis that an injured worker might undergo, we were required to submit the actual treatment protocol for that. Those protocols and guidelines change constantly as new medical information becomes available, new procedures and technologies become available, new studies are done. So that's it's an ongoing and evolving process that's overseen in MCOs by board-certified physicians. When we approached Senator Walker about this, she agreed with us that that was not her intent in introducing 670, that the intent was to have the department oversee the process for adopting the guidelines. We believe that the requirement to submit all the guidelines for review is unnecessary, and we believe and the department agrees that there was really no attendant public benefit to undergo that process. Furthermore, it seems to be a bit unproductive since there are no medical personnel on staff at the Workers' Comp Division to review these medical treatment guidelines. So it was sort of a make-work, paper-pushing exercise at best. Senate Bill 563 remedies the unintended consequences of Senate Bill 670 by relieving the managed care organizations of the requirement to submit all the guidelines and protocols, but retaining the requirement to submit the process for adopting the same. Thank you for the opportunity to speak on this bill, and I'll be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Sir, go ahead. Bless you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jerry Manahan. I'm the Deputy Administrator of the Workers' Compensation Division. That's part of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. Just so you know, under the workers' comp law, a managed care organization is an organization that's formed and developed by a health care provider or a group of medical service providers who then contract with carriers to provide health care for injured workers. And I also like to support what Ramona just said. In regard to the bill, we did look at Senate Bill 670, and this created a tremendous process for the department. And we're here in support of Senate Bill 563 today. One of the things with Senate Bill 670 did, it eliminated any flexibility for the MCO as well as the department to work with changing treatment standards and protocols of the MCOs. The department, we approve and we certify managed care, and we certified all the processes that they have in providing the treatment for injured workers. We believe Senate Bill 563, it retains the oversight capability and regulatory authority of the director to review how a managed care organization is operating. And we also believe that it allows us to review the protocols and continue to, like I say, update the treatment standards and protocols as they take place throughout the year. With this, I'd like to just reiterate that Management Labor Advisory Committee has supported the bill, and I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Inflexible bureaucracy and more paperwork. I know some people that just love that. Any questions of these nice people? All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Would anyone else like to testify on Senate Bill 563 today? All right, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 563, open a work session on Senate Bill 563. Representative Esquivel.
Yes.
Myself here.
Mr. Chair, I move 563. Let's see, are we on A? Senate Bill 563A?
Is it A?
Yes, that's
right.
Yeah.
Although I do not have the...
I don't have
the engrossment.
I think it's...
Is it?
Right,
I don't think so.
Oh, it is 563. You are correct. Yes, you are correct. No, it is 563.
But the summary says 563.
Yeah. The administrator messed up, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay.
Just 563. Sorry about that.
You had me there for a second.
I was keeping on your toes.
That's right. My God, we read every word of that one.
You fooled, too.
Representative, Senate Bill 563.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 563 to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Esquivel moves Senate Bill 563 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? All right, Kristen, please.
Aye.
Representative
Berger.
Aye.
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 I never assign. I don't think I've assigned a bill all year, but I'm going to assign this to Representative Berger.
I knew it was coming. See this? I had this ready.
And I look forward to a floor speech. I'm going to close the and I want it to be a barn burner. I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 563, and I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 592A.
Mr. Chair, committee members, Senate Bill 592A makes a number of statutory changes that reflect current changes of federal law in regards to the services that credit unions can provide. Amongst the changes include the allowance of credit unions to sell checks, money orders, and other money transfer instruments to credit union members, and to cash checks or money orders, and to send or receive domestic or international electronic funds transfers. The measure also allows to the new credit unions to charge fees for cashing checks or money orders and sending and receiving electronic transfers for persons that are eligible for membership. It also limits the fees that the credit unions may charge for cashing checks or money orders depending on the type of transaction taking place. It also permits credit unions that have a predominantly low-income membership to accept deposits from non-members and to issue uninsured secondary capital accounts subordinate to other claims against the credit union.
Thank you. I have Ms. Levitt, and I would assume Mr. Scoggins.
That is correct.
And I'd like Mr. Tatman. I hope I come on up, too. All right, Pam, whenever you're ready.
Great. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Pam Levitt, representing the Credit Union Association. You have before you Senate Bill 592, which is the work of our state charter credit unions in Oregon. We review the Oregon Credit Union Act, ORS 723, every year to make what we consider technical changes. And this is the product. The bill did pass out of the Senate Business Committee unanimously and on the Senate floor. Sometimes the federal government decides to do creative things, not often, but sometimes, and so we'll look to see some of the new powers that federal charter credit unions have and some of the provisions like the check cashing provision and the low-income designation. Those are products of which the federal charters already do have those powers. We are looking to continue to work with the Department of Consumer and Business Services, our regulator. We have a wonderful working relationship, and we set sat down and worked on several of the provisions with them, and some of the changes are the result of their recommendation. Hal Scoggins is the attorney for credit unions in Oregon and represents the Credit Union Association of Oregon, and he's going to talk about just a couple of the provisions. Quickly.
Thank you, Chair Schauffele, members of the committee. I won't do a blow-by-blow recount of everything that's in the bill. I'll really just focus on a couple of the changes that are what we consider the centerpiece of the bill. And these changes are designed to enable state chartered credit unions in Oregon to more better and more fully serve those people, those members of the community that are underserved or unbanked and have had difficulty getting access to financial services. And these are the provisions that Pam mentioned. First of all, one provision would enable state chartered credit unions in Oregon to obtain a low-income designation, meaning essentially that most of their members are what are considered low-income members in accordance with rules that would be established by the Department of Consumer and Business Services. Federal credit unions have the same type of procedure, and what this would enable the credit unions to do is to do two primary things. One is to accept deposits from non-members, and the second is to offer what's called secondary capital accounts, and these are accounts that would not be deposits, and they wouldn't create a debtor-creditor relationship the way a deposit would, but it would enable, usually it tends to be other credit unions or charitable organizations, to place money with the credit union that could be counted as capital that will enable a credit union to grow and have more funds available to lend to its low-income membership. If a credit union has low-income membership, these tend to be the types of members that are more heavy users of loan services as opposed to deposit-type services. And because of that, it's helpful to enable credit unions that are low-income credit unions to accept these deposits from non-members. It would not create a membership relationship, would not give them access to other services, but these two powers would enable the credit unions to be better able to generate the cash necessary to service their low-income members and still continue to build strength and financial stability of the credit union. Then the second service that would be available under this bill for credit unions is the ability to do check cashing and what we call money transmission services for non-members. And this would be limited to non-members who are actually within the credit union's field of membership. So, for instance, if you had a credit union that served only Clackamas County residents, then it would be able to provide these services to Clackamas County residents who might not be members of the credit union. Now, why would you ask that a credit union would think it would be appropriate or advantageous to do that? Why would it be helpful to the community for the credit union to do that? Well, again, looking at these people that are underserved by other financial institutions and what some people would call unbanked, a lot of them, for many reasons, do not feel that it's a good idea for them to maintain an account in a credit union. They may simply not have enough funds that they think it's worthwhile to continue to maintain a deposit account. But they are out in the community earning income. They may have need to have use of financial services to, say, get a check, a money order, something like that, to pay their rent, do other things like that. But they just don't have enough ongoing financial wherewithal to make it worthwhile, at least in their mind, to maintain a deposit account relationship with a financial institution. This bill would allow credit unions to provide those services to those members of the community and again, enable them to reach out to those portions of the community that that are underserved. And there are other parts of the bill, and I'm happy to answer any questions that any of you have on it, but I just wanted to highlight those two key sections.
Thank you, sir. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is David Tatman. I'm the administrator for the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities, and that's a part of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. As Pam and Hal mentioned, we regulate the credit unions, among many other financial services entities that we regulate. And I just want to touch briefly on a couple of things by way of background. We regulate 21 credit unions with 140 branches in Oregon. There are 64 federal credit unions located in Oregon. Mm-hmm. There's a choice between getting registered as a federal or as a state credit union. Within the law, there's a provision that allows for any state chartered credit union to ask our agency to take up certain powers that a federally chartered credit union already has in Oregon. This, I think, is just a streamlining process that would allow certain things that we would state probably are beneficial, as Mr. Scoggins has said, to society, and therefore this would allow credit unions to do so without doing it on a case-by-case basis. So we think this is a good process. Generally, we're neutral on most of these changes. They seem to make sense to us. The one that was mentioned, I can speak to personally, and many of you probably can too, if you have children or a spouse that's not a member of a credit union and you have a vehicle and somebody has to co-sign on that vehicle, it doesn't make sense that somebody who isn't a member then couldn't co-sign. So for practical reasons, I think a number of these changes are beneficial. And with that, you've got my written testimony. I'll stop here unless you have questions.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Berger.
Yeah, this is probably for all three of you, but probably the DCPS. The Section 5 that we've been discussing, and I'm a little bothered by the looseness of the language when it says the director of DCPS by rule may establish guidelines without saying, you know, what those guidelines might look like. Is there some, do the federally chartered ones have guidelines for what constitutes a low income, a credit union which predominantly serves low income? Are there some standards that you would go for, or are you just going to make them up as they go along?
Mr. Chair and Representative Berger, there are federal guidelines. I have a copy of them in my file. If you'd like, I could send that to you.
Mr. Chair, if I could follow up on my question. I guess I don't know what a credit union that predominantly serves low-income members is. I guess I'm asking, do you know what that is? And if not, how are you going to measure that?
Mr. Chair and Representative Berger, there are standards, and they look at the actual income, and they actually did a study recently at the national level in which they looked at credit unions across the country, and we participated in that study and looked at the by zip code and by essentially by income, and said if you hit a certain percentage of the median income, then you are considered to be above or below low income, and I think it was like 80%. I don't remember, but I believe it was 80% of the median income. If you were at 80% of the median income, you're deemed to be low income. And so there is a factor that there's already in place that the feds have established, and we would probably work right off of that. The rulemaking process is one where we'd use an advisory group, and obviously we would have members from the credit union, but we'd also have members from a number of other groups, and probably the Oregon Bankers Association and other financial lobbyists. So I think we would get that fully vetted, and it wouldn't be just a one-sided process if that's the concern.
It is, and I appreciate your response. That's what I wanted to get on the record. Thank you.
And I think the nice people that draft this stuff, if they didn't leave it open, which I don't think was intended, but that is what it is, could avoid this angst. Refer to the federal standards.
Well, Mr. Chair, it is pretty loose language, and I just wanted to get on the record that there are standards that they will be using, that this is not something that DCBS is going to make up, and I think you put it on the record what I wanted to hear.
Thank you. Representative Escobar.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Pam, you alluded to this bill, but you never talked about 592A. Are you okay with that?
Oh, absolutely, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry I didn't update that, but yes, we were involved in working actually with DCBS on the Senate side with the amendments.
Any more questions? Representative Holby, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, I guess my question is to David. I see that the check cashing part, according to the staff major summary, is consistent with House Bill 2202. Can you tell me if there are any differences, what those differences are?
Mr. Chair and Representative Holby, we did use 2202 as the basis for our conversations. That was one of the amendments that we asked for at the time the bill was originally produced, and that's why there's 592A. They're fairly consistent, but if anything, the credit unions, I believe, are holding themselves to a higher standard. They're not charging as much, or potentially wouldn't be able to charge as much, particularly on those checks that are of the other kind. There's three kinds. There's a government check, payroll check, And the third area is other kind. And here the credit unions say we're going to use the same standards basically that we're using for the more secure checks, payroll, and government issued. So the standards are similar but tighter for the credit unions, if you will.
Mr. Chair and Representative Holby, if I might follow up on that, there is reference to that in my written testimony, and as Mr. Tatman mentioned, the standard for other checks is actually much lower. The standard for other checks in 2202 is 10%, and the standard in our bill is 3%. And with respect to payroll checks, the standard in the other bill is 3% or 3.5%, depending on the type of identification, and ours is actually a percent lower than that.
Thank you. Any further questions? All right. Well, thank you very much. Would anyone else like to testify on Senate Bill 592A today? All right, then. I'm going to close public hearing on Senate Bill 592A and we'll open a work session on Senate Bill 592A. Representative Escobedo.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move 592A to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Escobedo moves Senate Bill 592A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Kristen, please.
Aye.
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 Aye. Aye. Would anyone like to carry this bill?
I do.
Representative Rosenbaum, thank you very much. I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 592A, open a public hearing on Senate Bill 596.
Mr. Chair, committee members, Senate Bill 596 allows a contracting agency to limit compensation for a public contract to certified emerging small business enterprises if the contract is estimated to cost $100,000 or less and is funded by the emerging small business account. It passed unanimously out of the Senate Education and General Government Committee and passed out of the Senate with a 26-1 vote. And committee members, if you look at your staff measure summary, I missed identified the bill as A and gross. It is actually just the original measure for Senate Bill 596.
Teresa, we have Jessica Adamson and Michael Cobb.
I think.
Thank you. Jessica, whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Jessica Adamson here today on behalf of the Associated General Contractors. We're pleased to bring this bill to this committee with the Department of Transportation. This is a joint project that's coming out of a group called the Small Business Initiative that is trying to provide additional ways to open up the transportation contracting environment for small and emerging businesses. Current statute in ORS 279C allows public agencies to essentially create a sheltered market environment for firms if they can set aside contracts $50,000 or less for smaller women or minority-owned businesses and limit the competition for those projects only to those firms. This bill would allow for contracts that are funded through the Emerging Small Business Account, which is an account that's been set up for years and is funded with 1% of highway contract construction funds. It would allow the department to limit competition for contracts funded under that to emerging small business firms and allow those contract dollars to be up to $100,000. That amount hasn't been changed in years. This simply will allow the department to spend those monies more efficiently, get more contracts out, and allow more small and emerging businesses to have a chance to get into the highway construction market. This is a great bill, and we're pleased to be kind of working on this together.
Thank you, Mr. Cobb.
Yes, good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and committee members. For the record, my name is Michael Cobb. I'm the manager of the Office of Civil Rights for the Oregon Department of Transportation. And to just kind of piggyback on what was just said here, that amount was set in 1989. And obviously you cannot do as much with those dollars by today's standards. And in the testimony there, it's pretty telling to kind of jump to the end of the story here. There's a table on the very back, and as an example, we took a sampling of some wages here. Carpenter wages, $1989 dollars to January 07 dollars, from $17.87 to $28.49, 59% increase. There's a, oh, I'm so sorry that I'm not giving testimony.
Let's see.
Really?
That's
good.
I'm looking at the faces and I'm not seeing recognition.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm so sorry about that. There's a table on the back page of that that shows some wages and the increase that has occurred. Carpenters have gone up with burden wages 92%, cement masons 86%, laborers 83%, flaggers 103% from 1989 wages to today. Some material costs, just looking at concrete, has gone from $42 per cubic yard to $95 per cubic yard. Rebar, 18 cent per pound in 1989 to 38 cent per pound in 2007, and so on. Structural steel, 21 cents per pound up to 37 cents per pound. So you can see with the dramatic increases over the years that this increase would greatly enable the Oregon Department of Transportation to continue its ESP program. In the 05-07 biennium, our program, we funded over 90 contracts for a total of roughly $2,157,000, so we could do significantly more and thereby contributing more to the economy of Oregon, stimulating it. Thank you. Any questions?
Thank you. Any questions? These nice people. All righty then. Thank you very much. Anyone else like to testify on Senate Bill 596? I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 596 and open a work session on Senate Bill 596. Entertain a motion, Representative Esquivel.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 596 to the House floor with a due-pass recommendation.
Representative Esquivel moves Senate Bill 596 to the floor with a due-pass recommendation. Any question or any discussion?
It is 596.
Yes.
Okay, because I do have an A here.
See no further discussion. Kristen, please.
Aye.
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 Aye. Would anyone like to volunteer? Representative Holby, thank you very much. Close the work session on Senate Bill 596 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 734A.
Mr. Chair, committee members, Senate Bill 734A allows the issuance of stock to a director, officer, or employee of an Oregon bank for services performed. The measure requires that a plan to issue stock for services be approved by the holders of at least two-thirds of the outstanding shares of the institution or stock savings bank and by the Department of Consumer and Business Services. It also requires specific notice of the stock issuance plan, including the information that issuing shares will dilute the interest of existing shareholders.
Thank you. Tim Martinez, Steve Way, Andy Morrow. And gentlemen, I have a 3:45. And if you don't get done in time, I'm leaving it to Mr. Holvey, and he will be in your hands. You will be in his hands.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Tim Martinez.
But if he was in your hands, he'd be good hands.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Tim Martinez here on behalf of the Oregon Bankers Association. I guess I better say any questions. I would just point out I'm joined to my right by Steve Way, President and CEO of Silver Falls Bank out in Silverton, Oregon. To his right is Andy Morrow, an attorney with Foster Pepper in Portland. Administrator did a good job talking about the bill. I think it's fairly straightforward. It is an issue that is important, though, to a bank that does not operate under a holding company. We have worked out amendments with the department. It did pass the Senate 28-1. I'll let you figure out which one of the two that always vote no was the no. And I would turn it over to Mr. Way to answer or to briefly describe how this is going to affect banks like his around the state.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, my name is Steve Way. I'm President and CEO of Silver Falls Bank. I'm here in support of Senate Bill 734. Silver Falls Bank is a small community bank headquartered in Silverton. We are representative of most small community banks in that we don't have a holding company. As much as the banking landscape is competitive these days, the biggest competition we face is for employees. Recently, we had an incident where we could not retain the services of a commercial loan officer because we could not offer them stock grants in our company. So we would urge that you put us on the same footing, make it a level playing field with banks with holding companies so that we could use this to compete for employees. So I can answer any questions in the interest of time.
Sure. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Andy Morrow. I'm an attorney with Foster Pepper in Portland. I'm just here to answer questions. I helped in the drafting of the bill, and won't say more than that.
Any questions of these gentlemen?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Berger.
Gentlemen, other states have similar provisions, or was this something, an oddity that we didn't allow them? What's the, does anybody know?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, there are the statutes in other, some other states do permit this as they presently exist. The Oregon statute narrowly limited what could be used for compensation to just stock options.
Representative.
The purpose of my question, and I think you've answered it, is that there's always sort of a danger in a small organization on who has stock and who gets to, you know, I'm trying to protect shareholders here. I think we all are. Mm-hmm. And so I guess if this is something that only we're doing and is new, I would like to know that. If it's something that's been tried and true in other states without significant problems, I guess I would like to know that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, it has been done in other places. It is, and it is the technique that's used, as Mr. Way suggested, for bank holding companies in this state, and all of the business corporations have this ability. This is a situation where approval to take this action requires shareholder approval, a two-thirds vote. So it's, in that sense, more restrictive than what a business corporation would have to do. Protective of shareholders in that sense.
Thank you.
Any further questions of these gentlemen? All right, thanks, guys. Anyone else like to testify on Senate Bill 734A? Seeing none, I'm going to close public hearing on Senate Bill 734A. Representative Espinal.
I believe you have to open up a
work session on Senate Bill 734A.
Representative. Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 734A to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Esquivel moves Senate Bill 734A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none. Kristen, please.
Aye.
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 All right, would anyone like Representative Esquivel? Thank you very much. Anything for the good of the order?
Sure.
All right, with that, we're adjourned.